man's pant leg along the seam. The knife had hit him in the calf, and he was a bloody mess, but it could have been worse. "Leave it in," I told Carol, "and make sure he stays still. That's close to some big veins, and I don't want to open them trying to take it out. Stay close to him, and keep him from trying to take it out, okay?"
Yes,
all right," Carol said. She blinked her eyes at me several times. "I don't understand what's happening."
"Me either," I responded. I rose and went to stand beside Michael. "Those things are quite a bit stronger than I am," he said in a low rumble that the people behind us couldn't hear. "If they rush this door, I won't be able to hold it shut."
"I'm not sure they will," I said.
"But you're here."
"I don't think they're after me," I said. "If they were, they wouldn't be going after everyone else, too." Michael frowned at me.
"But you said they were fairies."
"They are," I said.
"But I don't think this was supposed to be a hit. There are too many of them for that. This is a full-blown assault."
Michael grimaced.
"Then there are people in danger. They need our help."
"And they're gonna get it," I said. "Listen, Hobbs can't stand light, any kind of light. It burns them and it can kill them. That's why they called up this murk before they came in."
"Murk?"
"It's matter from the Never Never. Think of it as a cellophane filter, only instead of being around a light, it is spread all through the air. That's why we couldn't see the light from my amulet, and why the muzzle flash of my gun was so muted. And that's how we're gonna take them out."
"We get rid of the murk," Michael said, nodding.
"Exactly," I said. I raked my fingers back through my hair and started fumbling through my pockets to see what I had on me. Not much. I keep a small collection of handy wizarding gear in the voluminous pockets of my duster. But the pockets of my winter coat contain nothing but a stick of chalk, 2 ketchup packets from Burger King, and a furry, lint-coated Tic Tac.
"Okay," I said, "let me think a minute."
Something slammed into the other side of the door and shoved Michael's work boots a good 18 inches across the floor. A claw flashed through the opening at me. I got out of the way, but the sleeve of my coat didn't. The Hobbs claws ripped 3 neat slits in the fabric. Michael lifted Amorakius in one hand and drove its blazing length through the sturdy door. The Hob screamed and pulled away. Michael slammed the door shut again and jerked the weapon clear. Dark blood sizzled on the holy blade.
"I don't mean to rush you," he said calmly, "but I don't think we have a minute."
Chapter 24.
"Damn it!"
I swore.
"This is my only winter coat!"
I closed my eyes for a second and tried to focus my mind to the task. A murk wasn't like other forms of fairy glamour. Those could create appearance and could simulate emotional states related to that appearance. The murk was a conjuration, something physical, tangible, that actually did exist and would continue to do so as long as the Hobbs gave it enough juice, metaphorically speaking. Wind might do it. A big enough wind could push the murk away. But it would have to be an awful lot of wind. The little gale I'd called up to handle Torelli's hitters would barely make a dent in it. I could probably do something more violent and widespread, but when it comes to moving matter around, you don't get something for nothing. There was no way I'd be able to maintain that kind of blast long enough to get the job done. I might be able to cut the murk off from the Hobbs. If I could sever that connection, it would prevent them from pouring constant energy into it, and poof, the murk would resume its natural state as ectoplasm. Of course, cutting them off wouldn't be a cakewalk. I would need some means of creating a channel to each and every Hob in order to be sure I got the job done. I didn't have anything I could use as a focus, and I had no idea how many of them were out there, anyway. An empowered circle could cut the power to a spell from the other side of the equation, isolating the Hobs from the flow of energy outside the circle. But the circle would need to encompass the entire freaking building. I doubted the Hobbs would be considerate enough to let me run outside and sprint around an entire Chicago city block to fire up a circle. Besides, I didn't have that much chalk. Running water can ground out a spell if there's enough of it, but given that we were inside a building, that wasn't in the cards. So how the hell was I supposed to cut off this stupid spell, given the pathetic resources I had? It isn't like there was a whole lot of ways to rob a widespread working of its power. My nose throbbed harder, and I leaned my head back, turning my face upward. Sometimes doing that seemed to reduce the pressure and ease the pain a little. I stared up at the office ceiling.
which had been installed at a height of 10 or 11 feet, rather than leaving the place open to the cavernous reaches of the old station, and beat my head against the proverbial wall. The ceiling was one of those drop-down setups, a metal framework supporting dreary yet cost-effective rectangles of acoustic material, interrupted every few yards by the ugly little cowboy spur of an automatic firefighting sprinkler. My eyes widened.
"Ha!"
I said, and threw my arms up in the air.
"Ha, ha, 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 ha. I am Wizard. Hear me roar."
Mouse gave me an oblique look and sidled a step farther away from me.
"And well you should," I bellowed, pointing at the dog, "for I am a fearsome bringer of fire."
I held up my right hand and with a murmur called up the tiny sphere of flame. The spell stuttered and coughed before it coalesced, and even then the light was barely brighter than a candle.
"Harry?" Michael asked, in that tone of voice people use when they talk to crazy people. "What are you doing?"
The drywall to one side of the door suddenly buckled as a Hobbs' claws began ripping through it. Michael bobbed to one side, temporarily leaving the door, held his thumb up to the wall as if judging where the stud would be, and then ran Amorakius at an angle through the drywall. The sword came back hissing and spitting while another Hob howled with pain.
"Without the murk, these things are in trouble," I said. "Carol, be a dear and roll that chair over here."
Carol, her eyes very wide, her face very pale, did so. She gave the chair a little push so that it came the last 6 feet on its own. Michael's shoulder hit the door as another Hob tried to push in. The creature wasn't stupid. It didn't keep trying to force the door when Amorakius plunged through the wood as if it had been a rice paper screen, and Michael's sword came back unstained.
"Whatever you're going to do, sooner would be better than later."
2 minutes, I said. I rolled the chair to the right spot and stood up on it. I wobbled for a second and stabilized myself and quickly unscrewed the sprinkler from its housing. Foul-smelling water rushed out in its wake, which I had expected and mostly avoided. Granted, I hadn't expected it to smell quite so overwhelmingly stagnant, though I should have. Many sprinkler systems have closed holding tanks, and God only knew how many years that water had been in there, waiting to be used. I hopped down out of the chair and moved out from under the falling water. I pulled out one of the pieces of chalk out of my pocket, knelt, and began to draw a large circle all around me on the low nap carpet. It didn't have to be a perfect circle, as long as it was closed, but I've drawn a lot of them, and by now they're usually pretty close.
Excuse me, Carol said. "What are you doing?"
"Our charming visitors are known as Hobbs," I told her, drawing carefully, infusing the chalk with some of my will as I did so. "Light hurts them." A Hob burst through the already broken drywall, this time getting its head and one shoulder through. It howled and raked at Michael, who was still leaning on the door. Michael's hip got ripped by a claw, but then Amorakius swept down and took the Hob's head from its shoulders in reply. Dark, blazing blood spattered the room, and some of it nearly hit my circle.
"Hey," I complained, "I'm working here."
"Sorry," Michael said, without a trace of sarcasm. A Hob slammed into the door before he could return to it and drove him several paces back. He recovered in time to duck under the swing of a heavy club, then swept Amorakius across the creature's belly and followed it up with a heavy, thrusting kick that shoved the wicked fairy out of the room and back into its fellows. Michael slammed the door shut again.
But it's dark, Carol stammered, staring at Michael and me alternately.
"They've put something in the air called murk. Think of it as a smoke screen. The murk is keeping the lights from hurting the Hobbs," I said. I finished the circle and felt it spring to life around me, an intangible curtain of power that walled away outside magic, including the murk that had been caught inside the circle as it formed. It congealed into a thin coating of slimy ectoplasm over everything in the circle, which is to say, me.
"Super," I mumbled,
and swiped it out of my eyes as best I could.
So, Carol said, "what are you doing exactly?"
"I'm going to take their smoke screen away."
I held the sprinkler head in my right hand and closed my eyes, focusing on it, on its texture, its shape, its composition. I began pouring energy into the object, imagining it as a glowing aura of blue-white light with dozens of little tendrils sprouting from it. Once the energy was firmly wrapped around the sprinkler, I transferred it to my left hand, and extended my right again.
But we don't have any lights.
Oh, we have lights, I said. I held out my right hand and called forth my little ball of sunshine. In the murk-free interior of the circle, it was as white-hot and as bright as usual, but I could see that outside of the circle, it didn't spread more than 5 or 6 feet through the murk out there.
Oh, my God, Carol said.
Actually, all the regular lights are on, too. They're just being blocked. The murk isn't shutting down the electricity. These computers are all on, for example, but the murk is keeping you from seeing any of the indicator lights.
Harry?
Michael called.
You rush a miracle worker, you get lousy miracles.
I called back in an annoyed tone. The rest of the spell was going to be a little tricky.
How are you doing that? Carol breathed.
Magic, I growled. Hush. I wore a leather glove over my left hand, as usual, which should offer my scarred skin a little protection. All the same, this wouldn't be fun. I murmured, Ignus infusarius, and thrust the end of the sprinkler into the flame floating over my right hand.
How does this help us? Carol demanded, her voice shaking and frightened.
This place still has electricity, I said. Maybe I was imagining the smell of burnt leather as the heat from the flame poured into the metal sprinkler. It still has computers. It still has phones.
Harry!
Michael said, swinging his head left and right, staring up at the ceiling.
They're climbing. They're gonna come through the roof.
I began to feel the heat, even in the nerve-damaged fingers of my left hand. It was going to have to be hot enough. I drew up more of my will, lifted the sprinkler and the flame, and visualized what I wanted. The tendrils of energy around it zipping out to every other sprinkler head in the whole building. And it still has its sprinklers. I broke the circle with my foot, and energy lashed out from the sprinkler to every other object shaped like it in the surrounding area. Heat washed out of me in a wave, headed in dozens of different directions, and I poured all the energy I could into the little ball of sunshine, which suddenly had several dozen sprinkler heads to absorb its energy instead of only one. It took maybe 10 seconds before the fire detector let out a howl and the sprinkler system chattered to life. People let out surprised little shrieks and a steady emergency klaxon wound to life somewhere out in the station. Sparks flew up from several phones, monitors, and computers.
Okay, I said, so the office doesn't have computers, but the rest still applies.
Michael looked up at me and showed me his teeth in a ferocious grin.
When?
I watched my little ball of sunshine intensely as the water came down. For maybe half a minute, nothing happened, except that we got drenched. It was actually kind of surprising how much water was coming down. Surprising in a good way, I mean. I wanted lots of water. Somewhere around the 60-second mark, I felt my spell begin to flicker, its power eroded away by the constant downpour.
Wait for it, I said. Ready?
At 2 minutes, my spell buckled, the connection to the other sprinklers snapping, the fire in my hand snuffing out.
Michael!
I shouted.
Now!
Michael grunted and flung open the door. Before he'd stepped through it, there was a sudden flutter of faltering power in the air, and the holy blade blazed with light brighter than the heart of the sun itself. He plunged through the door, and as the burning light of Amorakius emerged into the station at large, dozens or hundreds of Hobbs' throats erupted into tortured cries. The sound of the wicked fairy's screams was so loud that I actually felt the pressure it put on my ears, the way you can at a really loud concert. But louder still was the voice of Michael Carpenter, Knight of the Cross, avenging angel incarnate, bearer of the blade that had once belonged to a squire called Wart.
Lava quo de sodium!
Michael bellowed, his voice stentorian, too enormous to come from a human throat.
In nomine Dei, sana quo de sautium!
After the sword had left the room, I could see that all of the office lights had come back, as well as those outside.
Mouse!
I screamed.
Stay! Guard the wounded!
I hurried after Michael and glanced back behind me. Mouse trotted forward and planted himself in the doorway between the Hobbs and the people in the office, head high, legs braced wide to fill the space. Outside, the sprinklers were doing a credible impersonation of a really stinky monsoon. I slipped in a puddle of water and burning hob blood a few feet outside the door. The light from the sword was so bright, so purely,
even painfully white, that I had to shield my eyes with one arm. I couldn't look directly at Michael, or even anywhere near him, so I followed him by the pieces of hob he left in his wake. Several of the wicked fairies had been struck down by Michael's sword. They were the lucky ones. Many more, dozens that I could see, had fallen too far away for Michael to have reached them with the blade. Those were simply lumps of smoldering charcoal, spewing columns of greasy smoke, their meat flash-cooked away from bone. Some of the soon-to-be former hobs were still thrashing as they burned. Hell's bells. I don't call him the Fist of God as a pet name, folks. I followed Michael, alert for any dimming of the sword's light. If any of the sprinklers in the building were a different model from the one I'd used to focus my spell, it wouldn't have been able to heat them and trigger them. If Michael wound up plunging back into the murk, then the hobs, afforded a measure of protection from the light, would gang up on him, and fast. But as luck, or maybe fate, or maybe God, but probably a cheap city contractor, would have it, it looked like they'd all been the same. Water came down everywhere, washing away the murk as if it had been a layer of mud, replacing it with thousands upon thousands of fractured rainbows, as the pure illumination of Amorakius shone through the artificial downpour. For the hobs, there was nowhere to hide. I followed the trail of smitten fiends. Smitten fiends? Smited fiend? Smoted fiend? Don't look at me, I never finished high school. Maybe learning the various conjugations of to smite had been in senior year English. It sure as hell hadn't been on my GED test. I stopped and peered around as best I could through the blinding light and steady fall of water from the sprinklers, trying to get an idea of where Michael was headed. I felt a sudden, swift vibration that rose through the soles of my shoes and then a heavy thud accompanying a second such tremor. I whirled to face the front of the building as glass and brick and stone exploded from the entry door. Behind it was a vague flicker of haze in the air, but as whatever was behind the veil entered the glare of Amorakius and my impromptu thunder shower, the spell faltered and vanished. 20 feet and 4 or 5 tons of Big Brother Gruff erupted from the veil. He wore armor made of some kind of translucent crystal, and the sword in his hand was longer than my freaking car. His mouth opened, and I felt his battle roar, rather than hearing it over the cacophony of combat. A sound so deep and loud that it should have been made by a freaking whale. "Oh, yeah," I muttered. "Today just keeps getting better and better." Chapter 25. Anybody with an ounce of sense knows that fighting someone with a significant advantage in size, weight, and reach is difficult. If your opponent has you by 50 pounds, winning a fight against him is a dubious proposition at best. If your opponent has you by 8,050 pounds, you've left the realm of combat and enrolled yourself in Roadkill 101, or possibly in a Tom and Jerry cartoon. My body was already in motion, apparently having decided that waiting on my brain to work things through was counterproductive to survival. It was thinking that the cat and mouse analogy was a pretty good one. While I was nimbler and could accelerate more swiftly than the huge Gruff, he could build up more speed on a straightaway. Physically speaking, I had almost no chance of seriously harming him, while even a love tap from him would probably collapse my rib cage. Another similarity. Jerry wins on television, but in real life, Tom would rarely end up with the short end of the stick. I don't remember Mister ever coming home nursing mouse-inflicted wounds. For that matter, he hardly ever came home with one of his rambles hungry. Playing cat and mouse is generally only fun for the cat. My body, meanwhile, had flung itself to one side, forcing Tiny to turn as he pursued me, limiting his speed and buying me a precious second or three, time enough for me to sprint toward a section of floor marked off by a pair of yellow caution signs, where Joe the janitor had been waxing the floor. I crossed the wet, slick floor at a sprint and prayed that I wouldn't trip. If I went down, it would take only one stomp of one of those enormous hooves to slice me in half. Footgear like that isn't so hot for slippery terrain, though. As soon as I crossed to the other side of the waxed floor, I juked left as sharply as I could, changing direction.
Tiny tried to compensate, and his legs went out from under him. That isn't a big deal by itself. Sometimes when you run, something happens, and you trip and you fall down. You get a skinned knee or two, maybe scuff up your hands, and very rarely you'll do something worse, like sprain an ankle. But that's a human mass. Increase the mass to tiny size, and a fall becomes another animal entirely, especially if there's a lot of velocity involved. That's one reason why elephants don't ever actually run. They aren't capable of it, of lifting their weight from the ground in a full running stride. If they fell at their size, the damage could be extreme, and evidently nature had selected out all those elephant wind sprinters. That much weight, moving at that much speed, carries a tremendous amount of energy, enough to easily snap bones, to drive objects deep into flesh, to scrape the ground hard enough to strip a body to the bone. Tiny must have weighed twice what an elephant does. 5 tons of flesh and bone came down all along one side of his body and landed hard, then slid, carrying so much momentum that Tiny more resembled a freight train than any kind of living being. He slid across the floor and slammed into the wall of the rental car kiosk, shattering it to splinters, and went right on through it, hardly even slowing down. Tiny dug at the floor with the yellow nails of one huge hand, but they didn't do anything but peel up curls of wax as he went sliding past me. I slammed on the brakes and tried to judge where Tiny looked like he'd coast to a halt. Then I drew in my will. It was difficult as hell in the falling water, but I didn't need a lot of it. When it comes to intentionally screwing up technology, I've always had a gift. I focused on the lights above the entire section of the station Tiny slid into, lifted my right hand, and snarled,
"Hexus!"
Some of them actually exploded in showers of golden sparks. Some of them let out little puffs of smoke, but every single one of them went out. Michael had advanced down the concourse far behind me, and the light of Amorakius was now shielded by the station's interior walls. When I took out the electric lights, it created a genuine swath of heavy shadows. The sudden island of darkness drew Hobbs like corpses draw flies, burned, terrified, furious Hobbs, whose tidbit-filled night on the town had suddenly turned into a nightmare. They didn't have eyes, but they found their way through the dark easily enough, and I saw more than a dozen rush in, one of them passing within a couple of feet of me without ever slowing down or taking note of my presence. Tiny started bellowing a second later, his huge voice blending with the vengeful howls of angry Hobbs. "Ain't so big now," I panted, "are ya?" But as it turned out, Tiny was just as big. A crushed Hob flew out of the shadows and splattered on the floor maybe 20 feet away. I don't mean that he was just ragdoll limp. He was crushed, crushed like a beer can, where Tiny's huge fist had simply seized the Hob, squeezed it hard enough to empty it of various internal liquids, and then thrown it away. Light flashed in the shadows, a long streak of sparks, like flint drawn along a long, long strip of steel, and suddenly low, blue flames surrounded the blade of Tiny's sword. They were guttering, barely able to stay alight beneath the falling water, but they cast enough light to let me see what was happening. The Hobbs had gone mad with hate. It had been inevitable, I suppose. The minions of winter and those of summer do not play well with one another, and the denizens of faerie do not behave like human beings. Their natures are far more primal, more immutable. They are what they are. Predators are swift to attack prey that has fallen and is vulnerable. Winter fae hate the champions of summer. The Hobbs were both. Several of them threw themselves at Tiny's head, while the others just started hacking with their crude weapons or biting with their shark-like teeth. Tiny's armor served him well in that mess, defending the most critical areas, and as Hobbs went for his throat, the gruff started throwing his head back and forth. I thought that it was panic for a second, until he slammed one of his horns into a Hob with such power that it broke the wicked fairy's skull. His sword slewed back and forth in 2 quick, precise motions, and 6 Hobbs fell dead and burning. The others let out shrieks of terror and bounded away, their hatred insufficient to the task of withstanding the fallen gruff. Tiny rolled to his knees and began to push himself up, and although his expression was contorted with pain, his inhuman eyes swept around until they spotted me.
Oh, crap. I didn't wait for him to get up and kill me. I ran. Of all the times to do without my jacket and staff, for crying out loud, what had I been thinking? That I had summer so thoroughly outwitted that I wouldn't need them? That life just hadn't been challenging enough until now? Stupid, Harry. Stupid, stupid. I swore that if I lived through this, I'd make up dummy copies of my gear for when I needed Thomas to play stalking horse. The ground started shaking as Tiny took up the chase behind me. My options were limited. To my right was the exterior wall of the building, and I couldn't go outside into the deepening snow. My imagination treated me to a dandy image of me floundering in hip-deep snow, while Tiny, with his far greater height and mass, cruised effortlessly up behind me and beer-canned me. Ahead of me was an empty hallway leading to another wall, and on my left were nothing but rows and rows of storage lockers. I fumbled in my pocket again as I ran through the water sheeting the floor and started trying to get a look at the numbers on the lockers. I spotted the one corresponding to Guard's key, and I skidded to a halt on the watery floor. I jammed the key in the lock frantically as Tiny, running with a limp but still running, closed the last dozen yards between us. I had to time it perfectly. I raised my right hand, aimed at the hoof on his wounded leg, and waited for all of his weight to come forward onto it before triggering every energy ring on my right hand, unleashing a rushing column of force that hit him with the power of a speeding car. The gruff's hoof went out from under him again on the wet floor, and he pitched forward with a roar of frustration. He dropped his blade and reached for me with both hands as he fell. I waited until the last second to jump back, ripping open the door to Guard's locker as I went. I could only describe what happened next as a bolt of lightning. It wasn't lightning, not really. Real lightning did not have the raw, savage intensity of this thing. And I realized, with a startled flash of insight, that this energy, whatever it was alive. White, hot power, tinged with flashes of scarlet, streaked out of the locker like 100 hyperkinetic serpents, zigzagging with impossible speed. That living lightning ripped into Tiny, cutting through his crystalline armor as if it had been made of soft wax. It burned and slashed and pounded the flesh beneath, in a long line from Tiny's shoulder to his lower leg, letting out a screaming buzz of sound unlike anything I've ever heard before. In the last fraction of a second before it vanished, the energy snapped back and forth like the tip of a whip, and Tiny's left leg came off at the knee. The gruff screamed. Whatever that thing had been, it had taken the fight out of Tiny. Hell's bells. I stared at the maimed summer champion and then at the open, innocent-looking locker. Then I walked slowly forward. Tiny had only one eye open, and it didn't look like it would focus on anything. His breathing was rough, quick, and ragged, which translated into a seething, oat-scented breeze anywhere within 10 or 15 feet of his head. Tiny blinked his other eye open, and though they still wouldn't focus, he let out a weak-sounding grunt.
"Mortal," he rasped. "I am bested."
One of his ears flicked once, and he exhaled in a sigh.
"Finish it."
I walked past the fallen gruff without stopping, noting as I did that the stroke of energy that had severed his leg had cauterized it shut, too. He wasn't going to bleed to death. I peered cautiously into the locker. It was empty, except for a single flat wooden box about the size of a big backgammon kit. The back wall of the locker sported something else, the blackened outline of some sort of rune. It wasn't the first time I'd seen Guard employing some kind of rune-based magic, but I'd be damned if I knew how it was done. I reached out with my wizard senses cautiously, but felt nothing. Whatever energy had been stored there was gone now. What the hell? I reached in and grabbed the box. Nothing ripped me into quivering shreds. I scowled suspiciously and slowly withdrew the box, but nothing else happened. Evidently, Guard had considered her security measures to be adequate for dealing with a thief, or a dinosaur, whichever. Once I had the case, I turned back to the gruff.
"Mortal," Tiny wheezed. "Finish it."
I try not to kill anything unless it's absolutely necessary, I replied. And I've got no need to kill you today. This wasn't a personal matter. It's done. That's the end of it. The gruff focused his eyes and just stared at me for a startled moment.
Mercy? From a Winterbound?
I'm not bound, I snapped. This is purely temp work. I squinted around. I think the hobs have mostly cleared out. Can you leave on your own, or do you need me to send for someone? The gruff shuddered and shook his huge head.
Not necessarily. I will go.
He spread the fingers of one hand on the ground and started sinking into it as if it were quicksand. As portals to fairy went, that was a new one for me. This is a one-time offer, I told him, just before he was completely gone. Don't come back.
I shan't, he rumbled. His eyes sagged closed in weariness. But mark you this, wizard.
I frowned at him.
What? My elder brother, he growled, is going to kill thee.
Then Tiny sank into the floor and was gone.
Another one? I demanded of the floor. You've got to be kidding me.
I leaned against the lockers for a second, banging my head gently against the steel for a moment. Then I pushed myself back onto my feet and started jogging back toward where I had parted with Michael. Just because the hobs were gone from this part of the station didn't mean that there wasn't still a fight going on. Michael might need my help. I picked up the trail of body parts again, though by this time most of them were mounds of dark powder, like charcoal dust, pounded into a gooey paste by the building's sprinklers. The patches of gunk got thicker as I continued in the direction I thought Michael had gone. I followed the trail to the base of a ridiculously broad flight of stone stairs, the one that actually had been in the Untouchables. The parts were still recognizable as parts here. These hobs hadn't been dead for long. They lay in a carpet of motionless, burning corpses on the stairs. Judging by the way they'd fallen, they had been facing up the stairs when they died. Several fallen hobs bore wounds that indicated that Michael had hewed his way through them from behind. White knight he might be, but once that sword comes out, Michael puts his game face on. And he plays as hard as almost anyone I've ever seen. Not that I could blame him. Not all the remains I'd passed had been those of Hobbs. Three security guards were down, one maybe 10 feet from the stairs, the other two on the stairway itself. They had fallen separately in the darkness. I'd passed several other bloodstains that had almost certainly been fatal to their donors, unless the falling water had made them look more extensive than they actually were. I'd never encountered Hobbs face to face before, but I knew enough about them to hope that whoever had spilled that blood was dead. Hobbs had a habit of hauling victims back into their lightless tunnels. I shuddered. I'd give the troubleshooters from Summer that much. All the gruffs wanted to do was kill me, clean, and that would be the end of it. I'd been carried into the darkness by monsters before. It isn't something I'd wish on anyone. Ever. You don't really live through it, even if you survive. It changes you. I pushed away bad memories and tried to ignore them while I thought. Some of the Hobbs had obviously taken their victims and run. According to the books, it was their modus operandi, though this entire attack seemed to indicate a higher level of organization than the average rampage. Obviously, whoever was behind it wasn't in complete control. Fairies share one universal trait. Their essential natures are actively contrary, and they are notoriously difficult to command. The Hobbs on the stairs were different from the ones I'd had to contend with at the front of the station. These all bore more advanced cutlery, probably made of bronze, and wore armor made of some kind of leather hide. To be clustered this thickly on the stairs, they had to have been at least a little organized, fighting in ranks, too. Something had compelled these Hobbs to attack in unison. Hell, if the numbers of fallen Hobbs in front of me were any indication, the gang that came after Michael and me were probably stragglers who had gone herring off on their own, looking for a little carryout to take home. So what had been the purpose of the attack? What the hell had drawn them all to the stairway? Whatever was at the top, obviously. Above me, the light of the holy sword flickered and began to fade. I chugged up the stairs as it did, still holding my fingers up to shield my eyes until the light dwindled and caught up to Michael. He was breathing hard, sword still raised over his head in a high guard and ready to come sweeping down. I noted, idly, that the stench of stagnant water had vanished, replaced by the quiet, strong scent of roses. I lifted my face again and felt cool, clean, rose-scented water fall on my face. Falling through the light of the holy sword had improved it, it would seem. The last hob to die, a big brute the size of a freaking mountain gorilla, lay motionless near Michael's feet. What was left of a bronze shield and sword lay in neatly sliced fragments around the body. Its blood spread sluggishly down the stairs, coated with blue-white flame as its body was slowly consumed by more of the same.
"Everybody can relax," I panted as I caught up to Michael. "I'm here."
Michael greeted me with a nod and a quick smile.
"Are you all right?"
"Not bad," I said, barely resisting the temptation to turn the second word into a barnyard sound. "Sorry I wasn't much use to you once you waded in."
"It couldn't have happened without your help," Michael said seriously. "Thank you."
"De nada," I replied. I went up the last few stairs and got a look at what the Hobbs had been after.
Children. There must have been 30 kids around 10 years old up at the top of the stairs. All of them in school uniforms. All of them huddled together in a corner. All of them frightened. Most of them crying. There was one dazed-looking woman in a blazer that matched those of the children, together with two women dressed in the casual uniforms of Amtrak stewards. "A train had just arrived," I murmured to Michael as I realized what had happened. "It must have gotten in through the weather somehow. That's why the Hobbs were here now."
Michael flicked Amarakius to one side, shaking off a small cloud of fine black powder from the blade as he did. Then he put the weapon away.
"It should be safe now, everyone," he said, his voice calm. "The authorities should be here any minute." He added in a quieter tone, "We should probably go."
"Not yet," I said quietly. I walked into the great hall far enough to see the area behind the first of a row of Corinthian pillars that lined the walls. Three people stood there. The first was a man, of a height with Michael, but built more leanly, more dangerously. He had hair of dark gold that fell to his shoulders, and the shadow of a beard resulting from several days without shaving. He wore a casual dark blue sports suit over a white t-shirt, and he held the bronze sword of a Hob, stained with their dark blood, in either hand. He regarded me with the calm, remote eyes of a great cat, and he showed me some of his teeth when he saw me. His name was Kincaid, and he was a professional assassin. Next to him was a young woman with long, curling brown hair and flashing dark eyes. Her jeans were tight enough to show off some nice curves, but not too tight to move in, and she held a slender rod maybe 5 feet long in one hand, carved with runes and sigils not too unlike mine. Captain Lucio had a long plastic tube hanging from a strap over one of her shoulders, its top dangling loose. Odds were good that her silver sword was still stowed inside it. I knew that when she smiled, she had killer dimples, but from the expression on her face, I wasn't going to be exposed to that hazard anytime soon. Her features were hard and guarded, though they did not entirely hide a fierce rage. Hopefully, it was reserved for the attacking Hobbs and not for me. The captain was not someone I wanted angry at me. Standing between and slightly behind the two adults was a girl, not much older than all the other children who had taken refuge in the hall. She had grown more than a foot since the last time I'd seen her, about 5 years ago. She still looked like a neatly dressed, perfectly groomed child, except for her eyes. Her eyes were creepily out of place in that innocent face, heavy with knowledge and all the burdens that come with it. The archive put a hand on Kincaid's elbow, and the hired killer lowered his swords. The girl stepped forward and said,
"Hello, Mr. Dresden."
"Hello, Ivy," I responded, nodding politely. "If these creatures were under your command," the little girl said in a level tone, "I'm going to execute you." She didn't make it a threat. There wasn't enough interest in her voice for it to be that. The archive just stated it as a simple and undeniable fact. The scary part was that if she decided to kill me,
there'd be little I could do about it. The child wasn't simply a child. She was the archive, the embodied memory of humanity, a living repository of the knowledge of mankind. When she was 6 or 7, I'd seen her kill a dozen of the most dangerous warriors of the Red Court. It took her about as much effort as it takes me to open the wrapper on a stack of crackers. The archive was power with a capital P and operated on an entirely different level than I did. Of course they weren't under his command, Lucio said. She glanced at me and arched an eyebrow. How could you even suspect such a thing? I find it unlikely that an attack of this magnitude could be anything but a deliberate attempt to abduct or assassinate me. Mab and Titania have involved themselves in this business, the archive said in a matter-of-fact tone. Mr. Dresden is currently Winter's emissary in this affair. And need I remind you that Hobbs are beholden to Winter, to Mab? She hadn't needed to remind me, though I'd been putting that thought off for a while. The fact that Hobbs were Mab's subjects meant that matters were even murkier than I thought, and that now was probably a reasonably good time to start panicking. But first things first, prevent the scary little girl from killing me. I have no idea who was ordering these things around, I said quietly. The archive stared at me for an endless second. Then that ancient, implacable gaze moved to Michael. Sir Knight, she said, her tone polite, will you vouch for this man? Maybe it was just my imagination that it took Michael a second longer to answer than he might have done in the past. Of course. She stared at him as well, and then nodded her head. Mr. Dresden, you remember my bodyguard, Kincaid? Yeah, I said. My voice didn't exactly bubble with enthusiasm. Hi, tough guy. What brings you to Chicago? Kincaid showed me even more teeth. The midget, he said. I hate the snow. If it was up to me, I'd much rather be somewhere warm, say Hawaii, for example. I am not a midget, the archive said in a firmly disapproving tone. I am in the 74th percentile for height for my age, and stop trying to provoke him. The midget's no fun, Kincaid explained. I tried to get her to join the Girl Scouts, but she wasn't having any of it. If I want to glue macaroni to a paper plate, I can do that at home, said the archive. It's hours past my bedtime, and I have no desire to entangle ourselves with the local authorities. We should leave. She frowned at Kincaid. Obviously, our movements have been tracked. Our quarters here are probably compromised. She turned her eyes back to me. I formally request the hospitality of the White Council, until such time as I can establish secure lodgings. I said. Lucio made a quick motion with one hand, urging me to accept. Of course, I said, nodding at the archive. Excellent, the archive said. She turned to Kincaid. I'm soaked. My coat and a change of clothes are in my bag on the train. I'll need them. Kincaid gave me a skeptical glance, but tellingly he didn't argue with the archive. Instead, he vanished quickly down the stairs. The archive turned to me. Statistically speaking, the emergency services of this city should begin to arrive in another 3 minutes, given the weather and the condition of the roads. It would be best for all of us if we were gone by then. Couldn't agree more, I said. I grimaced. Whoever did this is taking awful chances, moving this publicly. The archive's not quite human gaze bored into me for a moment. Then she said, matters may be quite a bit worse than that. I'm afraid our troubles are just beginning. Chapter 26. Michael stopped in his tracks when he saw the gaping hole Tiny the Gruff had left in the east wall of Union Station. Merciful God, he breathed. Harry, what happened? Little problem, I said. You didn't say anything to me. You look busy, I told him. And you already had a couple of 100 bad guys to handle. I nodded at the hole. I only had the one. Michael shook his head bemusedly, and I saw Lucio look at the hole with something like mild alarm. Did you get it? Michael asked. Lucio cocked her head at Michael when he spoke, and then looked sharply at me. I gave Michael a level look and said, obviously. Then I turned on my heel and whistled sharply. Mouse!
My dog, soggy but still enthusiastic, came bounding toward us over the water-coated marble floors. He slid to a stop, throwing up a little wave that splashed over my feet as he did. The archive peered intently at Mouse as he arrived and took a step toward him, but was prevented from going further by Kincaid's hand, which came to rest on her slender shoulder. Michael frowned at the girl and then at the dog. "This," he said, "brings up a problem." There was only so much room in the cab of Michael's truck. All of us were soaking wet, and there was no time to get dry before the authorities arrived. I didn't think it completely fair that I got a number of less than friendly looks on the walk to the garage after I explained that it had been me who set off the sprinkler system, but at least no one could claim that I hadn't been willing to suffer the consequences right along with them. The archive might have been a creepy Billy Mummy in Twilight Zone kind of kid, but she was still a child. By general acclamation, she was in the cab. Michael had to drive. "I'm not letting her sit there alone," Kincaid stated. "Oh, come on," I said. "He's a Knight of the freaking cross. He isn't gonna hurt her." "Irrelevant," Kincaid said. "What about when someone starts shooting at her on the way there? Is he going to throw his body in front of her to keep her from harm?" "I," Michael began. "You're damned right he will," I growled. "Harry," Michael said, his tone placating. "I'd be glad to protect the child. But it would be somewhat problematic to do that and drive at the same time." Mouse let out a low, distressed sound, which drew my attention to the fact that the archive had fallen uncharacteristically silent. She was standing beside Kincaid, shuddering, her eyes rolling back in her head. "Damn it," I said. "Get her into the truck. Go, Kincaid, Michael." Kincaid scooped her up at once, and he and Michael got into the cab of the truck.
"Is your house far from here, Warden?"
Lucio asked me. She didn't look good. Well, she looked good given the circumstances. But she also looked soaked and half-frozen already, kneeling to hug Mouse, ostensibly rubbing his fur to help dry it and fluff it out. I'd seen Lucio in action as captain of the Wardens of the White Council, and I'd formed my opinion of her accordingly. When I looked at the woman who'd faced Kemmler's disciples without batting an eye, whom I'd once seen stand in the open under fire from automatic weapons to protect the apprentices under her care, I tended to forget that she was about 5'4" and might have checked in at 130 or 140 pounds, soaking wet. Which she was. In the middle of a blizzard. "It isn't far," I said. Then I went up to the door beside Kincaid and said, "Put the kid on your lap." "She wears a seatbelt," Kincaid said. "She's in danger enough from exposure already." "Lucio doesn't weigh much more than Ivy does," I said in a flat tone. "She's in almost as much danger as the kid. So you're holding Ivy on your lap and letting my captain ride in the cab like a gentleman." Kincaid gave me a level look, his pale eyes cold. "Or what?" "I'm armed," I said. "You're not." He looked at me levelly, then at my hands. One of them was in my coat pocket. Then he said, "You think I believe that you'd kill me?" "If you try to make me choose between you and Lucio," I said with a brittle smile, "I'm pretty sure whom I'm going to bid aloha." His teeth flashed in a sudden wolfish smile, and he moved over, drawing the freezing child onto his lap. By the time I got back to Lucio, she was upright only because Mouse sat placidly in the cold, supporting her. She mumbled some kind of protest in a faint, commanding tone, but since she said it in Italian, I declared her brain frozen and assumed command of the local warden detachment, which was handy since it consisted only of me anyway. I bundled her into the truck's cab and got her buckled in beside Kincaid. He helped with it. My fingers were too cold and stiff to manage very quickly. "Harry," Michael said. He reached back, drew a rolled-up thermal blanket from behind the truck's front seat and tossed it to me. I caught it and nodded my thanks, with the cold already starting to chew at my belly. That left me and Mouse in the back of the truck, both of us soaking wet in the middle of winter, in the middle of a blizzard. The cold moved from my belly to my chest, and I curled up into a ball because I didn't have much choice in the matter. Magic wasn't an option. My palm-sized ball of flame wouldn't get along well with the back of a moving truck, especially given how much I was already shaking. I wanted to get warm, not set myself on fire.
"Sometimes chivalry sucks,"
I growled to Mouse, teeth chattering. My dog, whose thick winter coat wasn't much good after it had gotten a good soaking, leaned against me as hard as I leaned against him, underneath the rough blanket, while the cab of the truck heated up nicely, its windows fogging. I felt like a Dickens character. I thought about explaining that to Mouse, just to occupy my thoughts, but he was suffering enough without being forced to endure Dickens, even by proxy. So we made the trip in miserable, companionable silence. There might have been emergency lights going by us. I was too busy enjoying the involuntary rhythmic contractions of every muscle cell in my freaking body to notice. 30 seconds into the trip, I was fairly certain that I was going to black out and wake up 500 years in the future, but as it turned out, I had to endure only a miserable 20 minutes or so before Michael pulled up outside my apartment. Both vehicle doors opened to the weary but authoritative ring of Lucio's voice. "Get him to the door while he can still let us in through his wards." "I'm fine," I said, rising. Only it came out sounding more like, and when I tried to stand up, I all but fell out of the truck. Michael caught me, and Kincaid moved quickly to help him lift me to the ground. I dimly felt one of Kincaid's hands enter my jacket pocket and turn it out empty. "Son of a bitch," he said, grinning. "I knew it." Lucio emerged from the truck's cab, carrying the entirely limp form of the archive draped over one hip. The girl's arms and legs flopped loosely, her mouth hung open in sleep, and her cheeks were bright pink. "Get up, Dresden," she stated. Her voice was firm, but though warmed by the trip, she was still nearly as damp as she had been at the station, and I saw her buckle as the cold sank its teeth into her.
"Hurry."
I moved my feet in a vague shuffle, and remembered somewhere that when you walked, you moved them alternately. This improved our progress considerably. We reached a door, and someone said something about dangerous wards. "No kidding," I thought. "I've got some wards on my place that'll fry you to greasy spots on the concrete, but you should see the ones guard can do." Lucio snapped something to me about the wards, and I thought she looked cold. I had a fire at my place, which she could probably use. I opened the door for her, the way you're supposed to for a lady, but the damn thing was stuck until Michael shoved it open with his shoulder and muttered something disparaging about amateur work. Then everything got sort of muddled, and my arms and legs hurt a lot. I ended up thinking, "Man, my couch feels nice." Mouse snuffled at my face and then all but squashed me as he laid his head and most of his upper body across mine. I thought about chewing him out for it, but opted for sleep on my wonderful couch instead. Blackness ensued. I woke up to a room illuminated only by the light from my fireplace. I was toasty, though my fingers and toes throbbed uncomfortably. There was a gentle weight pressing down on me that proved to be virtually every blanket I owned. The deep, slow, steady sound of my dog's breathing whispered from the rug in front of the couch, and one of my hands was lying on the rough, warm, dry fur of Mouse's back. Water trickled nearby. Lucio sat on a footstool in front of the fire, facing the flames. My teapot hung on its latch over the fire. A basin of steaming water sat upon the hearth. As I watched, she dipped a cloth into the hot water and slid it over her shoulder and down the length of one arm, her face in profile to me. Her eyes were closed in an expression of simple pleasure. The light of the fire made lovely, exquisitely feminine shadows along the slender lines of her naked back, down to the waist of her jeans as she moved, muscles shifting beneath soft skin that shimmered golden like the firelight for a second after the warm cloth glided over it, leaving little wisps of vapor in its wake. Something else had never really occurred to me before, either. Lucio was beautiful. Aw, she wasn't cover girl pretty, though I suspected that with the right preparation she'd be damn close. Her features were appealing, particularly around her little cupid's bow of a mouth, framed by its dimples, contrasted with a rather squared-off chin that stopped half an eyelash shy of masculinity. She had dark eyes that flashed when she was angry or amused, and her medium brown hair was long, curling, and lustrous. She obviously took really good care of it, but there was too much strength in that face for her to be conventionally pretty. Beauty runs deeper than that.
There was an inexpressible quality of femininity about her that appealed to me tremendously. Some critical mixture of gentle curves, quiet grace, and supple strength that I had only that second realized happened to reside in the same place as the head of the wardens. Maybe more important, I knew the quality of the person under the skin. I'd known Lucio for years, been in more than one tight spot with her, and found her to be one of the only veteran wardens whom I both liked and respected. She shook her hair to the other side of her back and washed the other shoulder and arm just as slowly, and just as evidently taking pleasure in doing so. It had been a while since I'd seen a woman's naked back and shoulders. It had been considerably rarer than my views of the various nightmares my job kept exposing me to. I guess even among all the nightmares, sooner or later, you get lucky enough to catch a glimpse of a beautiful dream. And despite the trouble I was in, for just that moment there, under all those blankets, I looked at something beautiful. It made me wish I had the talent to capture the sight with charcoal or inks or oils, but that had never been my gift. All I could do was soak up that simple sight. Beautiful woman, bathing in firelight. I didn't actually notice when Lucio paused and turned her head to face me. I just noticed suddenly that she was returning my gaze, her dark eyes steady. I swallowed. I wasn't sure what I'd been expecting. Sudden outrage, maybe, or a biting remark, or at least a blush. Lucio didn't do any of that. She just returned my stare, calm and poised and lovely as you please, one arm folded across her breasts, while the other dipped the cloth into the steaming basin again. "Sorry," I said, finally, lowering my eyes. I was probably blushing. Damn it. Maybe I could pass it off as mild frostbite, heroically suffered on her behalf. She let out a quiet little murmur of sound that was too relaxed to be a chuckle. "Did it displease you?" "No," I said at once. "God, no, nothing like that."
"Then why apologize?" she said.
I coughed. I just figured that a girl who came of age during the reign of Queen Victoria would be a little more conservative. Lucio let out a wicked little laugh that time. "Victoria was British," she said. "I'm Italian." "Bit of a difference, then?" I asked.
"Just a little," she replied. "When I was young, I posed for a number of painters and sculptors, you know."
She tilted her head back and washed her throat as she spoke.
Though that was in my original body, of course."
"Right. The one that had been stolen by an insane necromancer, leaving Lucio's mind permanently trapped in a loner. A really young, fit, lovely loner. I don't see how the one you're in now could possibly come up short by comparison."
She opened her eyes and flashed me a smile that was entirely too pleased and girlish.
"Thank you. But I would not have you misunderstanding me. I'd avail myself of your shower, after being soaked in that foul soup. But the archive is on your bed, and Kincaid has closed the door. He's resting too, and I'd rather not have him go for my throat before he wakes. And you were asleep, so..." She gave a little shrug of her shoulders. It did really interesting things to the shadows the fire cast upon her skin, and I was suddenly glad of all the blankets piled on me.
"Are you feeling all right?" Lucio asked me.
"I'll live," I said.
"It was gallant of you to face down Kincaid like that."
"No problem. He's an ass."
"A very dangerous one," Lucio said. "I wouldn't have traveled with him if I had not seen him pass through the security checkpoint in Boston."
She rose, dropped the washcloth in the basin, and pulled her shirt on, giving me a rather intriguing view of her back and waist silhouetted against the firelight. I sighed. Moment over. Back to business.
"What were you doing traveling with them?" I asked.
"Bringing them here for the parley," she replied.
"Parley?"
"The archive contacted Nicodemus Arcleone regarding our accusations. He agreed to meet with us here in Chicago to discuss the matter. You are the initiating party in this instance, and I am here to serve as your second."
I blinked at her. "You? My second?"
She turned to face me as she finished buttoning her shirt and smiled faintly.
"Duty before ego.
Relatively few of the wardens with sufficient seasoning for the role were willing. I thought it might be best if you worked with me instead of Morgan.
That's why they pay you the big bucks, Cap.
That keen interpersonal insight. That, and because I'm quite good at killing things, Lucio said, nodding. She turned to the fireplace and took Guard's little wooden box off the mantel. Dresden.
Hell's bells, I breathed, sitting